In episode 3, we looked at the infamous Montjuïc street circuit in Barcelona, which first started to host race events in the 1930s and hosted its first Formula One Spanish Grand Prix in 1969. In that episode, we looked at the two near identical accidents involving Graham Hill and Jochen Rindt, which was the result of rear wing failure. They say that lightning doesn't strike twice in the same place, and already this theory was already disputed. But what about a third time? This race was surrounded with controversy before it had even started, as the drivers, particularly those who are members of the Grand Prix Drivers Association, were angered upon discovering the barriers on this street circuit were not bolted together properly. Until the barriers were fixed, the drivers went on strike and refused to take part in practice. Only a handful of drivers chose to take part in practice, including Jacques Yixt, whilst track staff worked all around the circuit making necessary repairs, which continued throughout the night. Even some teams sent their mechanics out to assist, since they had nothing else to do since the cars were still parked up silently in Montjuïc Stadium. By Saturday, the circuit was apparently ready for qualifying, but the drivers were still not convinced with the carelessness of the whole situation. In response, race organisers threatened legal action if the race did not go ahead, and the drivers were forced to call off the strike. Emerson Fittipaldi, who was defending world champion in 1975, was still incredibly angry, and as soon as he completed the minimum 3 laps required in qualifying, he pulled into the pits and called it a day. The following day, Emerson announced that he would not be racing, got on a plane and headed home. To make sure the circuit was absolutely ready, Ken Till had personally inspected the barriers early that morning and the race was given the go-ahead. But the race itself would be a disaster. Pole sitter Niki Lauda would crash out on the opening lap after a collision with the Parnelli of Mario Andretti. Clay Regazzoni in the other Ferrari was also hit by Lauda, which caused significant damage whereby Clay had to pit in for repairs. Wilson Fittipaldi and Arturo Misano would both withdraw after the first lap in protest over the mishandling of the race. Patrick Depailler would also retire after suspension damage. On the third lap, the engine on Jody Scheckter's Tyrrell blew up, which leaked oil onto the circuit, which led to Alan Jones, Mark Donoghue and James Hunt slipping and crashing out. 6 more drivers, including Tom Price, Andretti and Ronnie Peterson, would also retire over the next several laps. It was pure chaos in Montjuïc Park, but on lap 25, things took a dark turn for the worse. After all of these retirements, Rolf Stommelen was leading the race in his Embassy Hill, with the Brazilian Carlos Pache in the Brabham following closely in second. As the pair tackled the sweeping left-handed hill of Turn 1, the 1975 Spanish Grand Prix was about to come to a premature end. Just like in 1969, the rear wing of Rolf Stommelen's Hill GH1 ripped clean off the car just before he hit the jump of Turn 1. This sent Rolf's car spinning out of control and straight into the recently repaired barrier on the left-hand side. The car bounced off the barrier and cut across the track to the barriers on the right-hand side. Carlos Pache did his best to try and avoid him, but the two cars ended up colliding in the chaos. The collision with Pache, though, sent Rolf Stommelen's Embassy cartwheeling over the barrier and into the large crowd of spectators. 4 people were killed in the crowd. Photographers Mario de Roya and Antonio Fontbaiari. Spectator Andreas Ruiz Villanova. And firefighter Joachim Moreira Benaches. 5 other spectators suffered serious injuries but eventually recovered. Rolf Stommelen was also badly hurt after having suffered a broken leg, broken wrist and 2 broken ribs. It would take a while for Rolf to recover physically and mentally from this accident, and he would make his return to F1 4 months later at the Austrian Grand Prix. As the horrific scenes unfolded in the crowd, the race continued on until 4 laps after this accident. The race was finally stopped on lap 29 and was never restarted, with Jochen Mass being declared winner and half points awarded. Lella Lombardi also finished 6th, becoming the first, and as of 2024, remains the only woman to score points in F1. And with that, Formula One never returned to Montjuic Park, as the circuit's poor safety measures were clear for all to see. Spectator incidents at this time, sadly, were not uncommon. 2 years later, in Fuji during the Japanese Grand Prix, Gilles Villeneuve and Ronnie Peterson would have a dramatic accident at the end of the long and superfast straight. The collision, as the pair headed into Turn 1 side by side, resulted in Villeneuve's Ferrari being sent into the air and cartwheeled straight towards the crowd stood on the outside of the corner. This area was a prohibited section, and marshals were on hand to try and disperse the crowd of mainly photographers who had gathered there. Sadly, the Ferrari passed straight through the crowd and landed in a field just behind a makeshift wall. Kengo Yuasa, a marshal who was trying to move people away, was killed, as well as photographer Kazuro Ohashi. It is also sad to know that many drivers that we have mentioned in this segment would be killed within the next few years, including Rolf Stommelen. He suffered another rear wing failure at Riverside at 190 miles per hour whilst driving at the Los Angeles Times Grand Prix in the IMSA GT Championship on the 24th of April 1983. The failure sent Rolf into a concrete wall at a famous dogleg corner, somersaulted and caught fire. Rolf Stommelen died on the scene from multiple injuries, particularly to the head and chest. Motorsport can truly be cruel sometimes. Four months after the events of the Spanish Grand Prix, the F1 circus was now at the Österreichring, located within the beautiful Styrian region of Austria. Nowadays, this circuit is now known as the Red Bull Ring and has hosted F1 under this name since 2014. From 1970 to 1987, the Österreichring was much faster and longer than what it is today. The track originally carried on far beyond what is now Turn 1, into a flat-out sequence of right and left turns, known as the Hederlick Curve and Flatscha, before entering a sweeping uphill right-hander that fed into the back straight on the top of the hill, which was double the length of what it is now. It was one of the fastest circuits on the calendar, and to get an idea of how fast it was here, Derek Warwick was speed trapped at 214 miles an hour in qualifying on the approach to the Bosch curve in 1986. It was also considerably dangerous, with very little runoff areas in the fastest areas, especially at the Hederlick curve.
And he's left very badly indeed. Look how he's been passed. And there's another coming together. A car dragging along the Armco. 2-3 of them out. And one of them is Stefan Johansson. And there's a Ferrari down there. And they're all over the circuit. This is far worse than the first one. Streff is in trouble again. Fabra is in trouble again. Alio has stopped. There's at least 6 cars. Jonathan Palmer has stopped, but his car looks perfectly okay. Christian Danner has stopped. Well, this has to be some sort of condemnation, I think, of the Austrian circuit here. Is it wide enough? This is the second time it's happened.
No, just as I was about to say that, Murray, absolutely. The track is not wide enough here.
Just a few days before the Austrian Grand Prix, the world closed course speed record was broken at a Talladega Super Speedway, when a lone Porsche 917-30 set an average speed of 221.120 miles per hour over the 2.6 mile oval. The driver was Mark Donohue, who was very capable of throwing a 917-30 around a circuit. For much of his early career, the American was very successful in sports car racing, including the 24 Hours of Le Mans, where he made his debut there in 1966 in one of the Ford GT40s alongside Paul Hawkins. In 1967, he partnered with Bruce McLaren in another GT40, this time the new Mark IV. Donohue was a keen engineer, but so was Bruce. So quite often the duo would have very different views as to how to set a car up for the race, but they would eventually finish fourth despite their differences. Around this time, Donohue started to become close with Roger Penske, and the two would embark on various projects together. He would begin to find success in the Trans Am Sports Car Championship in the late 1960s, in which the championship included races such as the 24 Hours of Daytona and the 12 Hours of Sebring, the latter in which he won in 1967 and 68. Interestingly, the Penske-owned Chevrolet Camaro was dipped in an acid bath to make the car as lightweight as possible, even to the point people were warned not to lean against the car in case the body would dent. Despite race stewards wanting to ban this method of weight reduction, Roger Penske was able to convince them otherwise because he could convince Chevrolet to withdraw their support for the Trans Am series. With this threat in mind, Penske and Donohue continued to go on and almost dominate the Trans Am field. In 1971, Penske and Donohue began working with Porsche to help develop the new Porsche 917-10 for the Can-Am Sports Car Championship, when McLaren had been the trailblazers for the last couple of years, in a period known as the Bruce and Denny Show. Despite the hard work that had gone into the 917-10, it still remained lackluster compared to the dominant McLarens, and Peter Revson would be champion that year, with famed Porsche driver Joe Siffert finishing a respectful fourth. There was still plenty of work to do on the 917-10, but they suffered a huge setback when Mark Donohue was badly hurt in a testing accident at Road Atlanta in 1972. As they were testing new brake ducts on the Porsche, the rear bodywork flew off the car, resulting in an airborne crash, which ripped the front end away, leaving Donohue still strapped to his seat, with his legs dangling where the front end once was. Luckily, Mark survived, but his injuries meant that he had to step away from testing and driving the 917-10, leaving George Folmer to take the seat, and he went on to win the Can-Am Championship of 1972, winning 5 of the 9 races. Mark managed to drive in the last few races of that season, but he was involved in the development of Porsche's next entry, the 917-30, the most powerful racing car ever built. With its twin turbocharged 5.4-litre 12-cylinder engine, producing up to 1,600 horsepower. It eventually gained the nickname the Can-Am Killer, because in 1973, Porsche would completely dominate the season with the 917-30, with the capable hands of Mark Donohue winning 6 out of the 8 races. Interest in Can-Am quickly faded away from this season on, and eventually the series would fold altogether. Mark Donohue also won the 1972 Indy 500, but it would be at Indianapolis the following year, where events surrounding him would have a profound effect on Mark.
Doesn't look like a repeat of last year's start. No, it's a good one. And here they come. Bobby Upford going for the lead. Johnny Rutherford right alongside him. Rutherford down low, but Bobby, with a terrible crash on the home stretch. There are several cars involved. We can't see the numbers, but it's been a bad crash on the start. It was in the middle of the field somewhere. Terrible thing. This is what everyone is feared. This is why there's been such a terrible atmosphere of fear here all weekend long. A shame, there's the driver waving. He might be on fire, that man, the way he's waving. You can't see an alcohol fire. Those explosions are not cars. Those are the bombs overhead that are normally set off during the start of the race.
Yes, he is. Oh, my God, it's Savage! Oh!
What a crash.
Scott, yellow white.
The worst thing on the race.
That is the worst thing I've ever seen. On a race course anywhere. Tire, one tire must have fallen 100 feet in the air. I think he's in that, the one to the right. I can't even tell what part, each part of the car. It's just disintegrated. The red flag, of course, is that the race is stopped. Sweet Savage is moving inside that thing. The fire there. Now, Sweet is wearing, he is wearing one of these new suits where the foam automatically goes off inside the suit. Only four drivers in the race are wearing it. He is wearing it. If there's any hope, it might be in that.
Well, how it could be moving, Jim, is beyond me. I've never seen a car just disintegrate like that. You remember he made a pit stop just a little bit ago. The cars hold 75 gallons of fuel, and he hadn't burned much of that off. The race is...
Oh, somebody's been hit in the pit. A fire truck racing to the scene has hit a mechanic or somebody in the pit who's going the wrong way through the pit. They're trying to get Savage out of the car. The man was thrown in the air. Hit by a fire truck. Remember, now we're talking about two different people.
Unbelievably, Savage survived this accident, but sadly passed away 33 days later at 26 years old. The exact cause of this accident is still debated to this day, but we shall take a closer look into this accident and others that marred this weekend in a future video. Mark Donohue was one of Swede Savage's closest friends and was deeply saddened after witnessing the crash. The stresses that came with the development work with Porsche also caused him considerable strain, and his regular nickname of Captain Nice has slowly been replaced by Dark Monohue. He knew it was time to step away from racing, and after his dominating Can-Am Championship in 1973, he announced his retirement. But it wouldn't take long before Roger Penske appeared in his life once again and convinced Mark to join him on his new Formula One entry. Mark had made one previous appearance at the 1971 Canadian Grand Prix, where he managed to finish on the podium that day. This time it would be different, as nobody knew if Penske would be competitive or not, and after making two entries at the last two races of 1974, Penske and Mark Donohue stayed to take on a full F1 season in 1975. Things went well for the team, but they knew they could do better, as they were hampered by poor reliability from the Penske PC1. So they bought in a March 751, and things began to improve, with Mark achieving 2 points finishes in Sweden and Silverstone. He still very much had the skills to race at a competitive level, and perhaps maybe with his technical mindset, Mark and Penske would set out to win in Formula 1 just like they had done in the US. Before the start of the Austrian Grand Prix, however, this would all begin to collapse. Mark had struggled in qualifying on the ultra-fast Österreichring and could only place his March 21st out of 29 cars. In these days, warm-up sessions would take place on the morning of race day, whereby drivers could get their last bits of practice in before the long race ahead. Donohue went out for warm-up just like everyone else, and on his second lap, as he rose up the hill on the approach to the fast right-hander of Heller Licht, one of his rear tyres suddenly blew at 160 miles per hour. After the tyre blew, the out-of-control March speared through the 60 metres of catch fencing, intended to quite literally catch a car like a net. It then hit the barrier head first and vaulted right over it, before the car rolled down the bank and laid rest in a ravine. During this short period, Mark was knocked unconscious by either a fence post from the destroyed catch fencing, or he had knocked his head against an advertising hoarding. Nearby drivers stopped to help, including Emerson Fittipaldi, Hans-Joachim Stuck, and Bob Evans, who helped extract Mark Donohue from his wrecked car. Unfortunately, three trackside marshals were also struck down by flying debris and were severely injured. Mark regained consciousness a few minutes later and was easily able to talk with his rescuers as he was taken to Knittelfeld Hospital with head injuries. His injuries didn't seem to be as severe as it first seemed, and he was expected to make a full recovery. Later that same day, Mark started to experience headaches which got worse as the time went on, and he was transported to a different hospital in Graz. His condition didn't improve, and after lapsing into a coma, the 38-year-old Mark Donohue died 2 days later as a result of a cerebral hemorrhage. Worse still, one of the marshals who was hit by flying debris during the accident, Manfred Schaller, succumbed to severe abdomen injuries just a few days after the accident. He was only 21. Mark Donohue's death left a large hole in the heart of Roger Penske, and his F1 aspirations very quickly faded away, before finally stopping altogether in 1977, having only achieved one victory, the 1976 Austrian Grand Prix. Together, Penske and Donohue produced some of the greatest car designs that ever graced the American racing scene, with many of his early successes being a result of Mark's intelligent engineering mindset. His book, The Unfair Advantage, published just 1 year before he died, is Mark's step-by-step retelling of how he approached every single car he drove and how he used his engineering skills to bring out the best that he possibly could in those cars, including various experiments on Porsche prototypes. Following this accident, the Hellelicht curve was tightened for 1976, and then in 1977, a chicane was installed. Following several more severe accidents, including fatalities in touring car and motorcycle racing, the Österreichring was rebuilt in 1996, with the western section being simply abandoned. The Österreichring's new layout in 1996 is what you still see today on what is now known as the Red Bull Ring. The old western section still lays abandoned to this day, and the site of this accident is normally a go-kart track, but it's also used as an entranceway for Grand Prix weekends. Sometimes, we just think back and wish Mark Donohue had just stuck to his retirement plans. But you cannot stop a racing driver from doing what they do best. The 1994 San Marino Grand Prix is still referred to as one of the worst weekends in F1 history, but it's often forgotten that an equally, if not worse, weekend took place at Spa-Francorchamps in June 1960. In these times, Spa was 14 kilometers long on public roads. It was one of the fastest and most dangerous circuits in the world at the time, where almost every corner had something lying in wait if a driver made a mistake. Whether that be a house, a tree, straw bale, telegraph pole, brick wall, or perhaps even a barbed wire fence. Friday practice also had to start after 5:30 in the afternoon to allow local residents to return home after finishing work before the roads were shut off for Formula One cars to take to the streets. It was during the following day's practice session that the dark clouds of unfortunate events began to form over the Ardennes. Stirling Moss, who was one of the most experienced drivers at the time, who had 2 second place championships under his belt thus far, had not returned to complete another lap. As news travelled a lot slower in 1960, only other drivers could bring news as to what had happened. At the flat-out right-hander at Burnhamville, Moss's Lotus 18 had a rear axle failure which sent the car into a violent spin and straight into a grass bank, which ejected Stirling from his car. His injuries were severe, with a broken nose, back injuries, and broken bones in his legs, which kept him out of racing for most of the season, but he luckily survived. Almost at the exact same time on the other side of the circuit, Mike Taylor would also crash heavily at the La Carrera corner. His steering column snapped as he tackled the fast right-hander, and his Lotus went straight on into the forest at high speed. As there were no seatbelts, he was also thrown from his car and into the trees. His body even hit a narrow tree so hard he cut it down, but his injuries would be the end of his short racing career. He suffered broken ribs, a broken collarbone, and neck injuries which left him paralyzed. Thankfully though, he survived, and after a long period of therapy, he regained the ability to walk and would later successfully sue Lotus because of the failure in the steering. I wish I could say that the events ended here and the race went on without incident. As you could probably guess by now, this was only the beginning. With Jack Brabham on pole position, the 36-lap race got underway amongst a lot of confusion as the race started whilst cars were still being brought to the rear of the field, and a couple of cars had to avoid hitting mechanics on the grid. On lap 19, Willy Myres in the Ferrari was battling a young Chris Bristow in a Cooper, who was in his fourth F1 start of his career, and was hotly tipped to be a success for the future. Bristow was noted as being an incredibly aggressive driver in the club racing scene, whereby he would spin and or crash at almost every circuit he raced at. But when he was able to avoid trouble, Bristow was able to achieve fantastic results, including a third place finish at the non-championship 1959 Gold Cup race at Alton Park, just behind Stirling Moss and Jack Brabham in equal machinery. The following year, he would again finish third in a non-championship race, this time the Glover Trophy at Goodwood, finishing behind Innes Ireland and Stirling Moss once again, but had beaten Bruce McLaren, who had started to make a name for himself during this time. Since he was only 22 years old, it was only a matter of time before Chris would begin to show his true talent in Formula One. As Bristow and Myres ran nose to tail as they headed into the notorious Burnhamville right-hander, the same corner where Moss had crashed just a day prior, Bristow accidentally went off the racing line, and in his attempt to bring his car back online, he lost control of his Cooper and spun in the middle of the bend at approximately 130 to 140 miles per hour. As the car left the road and rolled, Chris was ejected from the car and went straight through some barbed wire fencing. He was decapitated. At 22 years old, Chris Bristow remains the youngest driver to be killed in a Formula One championship race. The rest of his body continued back onto the side of the track on the inside of the corner. According to multiple reports, his body lay by the side of the track for the remainder of the race, as nobody could safely get to him. Jim Clark, who passed through the area just seconds later, had to swerve to avoid hitting Bristow's beheaded body laying by the side of the road. The car was also a complete wreck, as it lay in a nearby farmer's field. Sadly, this was not the end of it. A promising Lotus driver by the name of Alan Stacey was also driving that day. He was one of Lotus's first poster boys, who had assisted Colin Chapman with the development of some of their earliest sports car efforts, including the Lotus 11. But what had concerned onlookers, though, was the fact that Alan had an artificial lower right leg after suffering a severe motorcycle accident when he was 17 years old. This meant that his cars would be modified with a twist throttle mounted to his gear lever to aid him when downshifting. Whilst it may have been uncomfortable for him, Alan wanted to prove that his disability wasn't an obstacle. His closest friend, John Whitmore, would tell stories of how Alan would sometimes rotate his right foot 360 degrees while sat in a bar or hotel to freak out unsuspecting onlookers. Interestingly, John Whitmore was also close friends with an aspiring young actor called Steve McQueen, who had yet made a name for himself in Hollywood, and the three men would often ride bikes together on the Whitmore estate. His conservative driving style may not have been spectacular to spectators, but he always did everything he could to get his cars to the finish, which was a difficult task given the poor reliability of Lotus Grand Prix cars. 1960 would be his first full-time drive for Lotus in F1, partnering up with Innes Ireland, John Surtees, and later a young rookie known as Jim Clark. At the Belgian Grand Prix of 1960, just a couple of laps after the death of Chris Bristow, Alan Stacey and his Lotus 18 would pass through the site of Bristow's accident and head on towards the Malmedy corner, when without warning, he speared off the circuit at high speed. The car hit a bank before being ricocheted across the circuit somersaulting before coming to a rest in a nearby field ablaze. The Lotus would burn into a shell, but Stacey was ejected from the car before the fire. However, sadly, who was already dead by the time his body was found. According to multiple witnesses, Allen was struck by a bird, which flew into his face at a closing speed of approximately 140 miles per hour. This impact would have most likely rendered Allen unconscious, but there is also a good chance that the impact could have killed him instantly. But we will never know what truly happened, and despite the sheer brutality of these accidents, the race carried on as normal until the checkered flag fell to Jack Brabham. The motorsport world was left reeling with sadness from an absolutely devastating weekend of racing at Spa, where two young drivers were killed just minutes apart in almost the exact same spot. Jim Clark, along with many other drivers, would go on to have a sincere dislike for the Spa circuit after these accidents, until Spa was dropped to host the Belgian Grand Prix after 1970. Strangely, bird strikes weren't actually that rare. During practice for the 1966 French Grand Prix at Ramsgeur, Jim Clark too would be struck in the face by a bird as he descended down the back straight towards the Thilio hairpin, suffering injuries to his face, which meant he had to withdraw from the event. It remains to this day the only F1 race where two drivers died on the same day. And let's just hope that it stays that way. In episode 2, many of you were shocked by the scenes at Zandvoort in 1973, when David Purley tried in vain to save the life of Roger Williamson in his burning car during the Dutch Grand Prix. Many of you spoke about the shock, anger and sadness that you felt after witnessing such scenes, especially during an era where F1 safety was starting to be taken seriously. However, Zandvoort is no stranger to scenes such as this. And I'll allow Peter Brook to tell you a story as to what happened here in 1970.
Formula One has always had a reputation of being a bit of a rich boys' club, and nowhere is this more true than in Piers Courage, who was born into an upper-middle-class family as the heir to the Courage Brewery fortune and was educated at Eton College, graduating in the same year as fellow future Formula One driver Jonathan Williams and Prince William of Gloucester and Prince Michael of Kent, grandsons of King George V and first cousins of Queen Elizabeth II. After graduation, he began training to be an accountant, but convinced his parents to allow him to purchase a Lotus 7 and began racing. In 1965, while in Formula 3, he met Frank Williams, himself a racing driver and mechanic, and in 1966 was signed by Colin Chapman to Lotus's Formula 2 outfit, and made his Formula 1 debut in Germany, and took a class win at the 24 Hours of Le Mans. In 1967, he got a full-time seat with Reg Parnell Racing, driving a customer BRM, but repeated spins and crashes meant he lasted only two races. By returning to Formula 2 and knuckling himself down and getting a win in the Tasman Series, he was re-signed for 1968. An uncompetitive car meant he scored only 3 points, and he had also been offered a seat with Lotus following Jim Clark's death, which he turned down. But in tandem with this, he had been driving for Frank Williams' Formula 2 team, and when he stepped up to Formula 1 with Frank Williams racing cars in 1969, Courage went with him. In a customer Brabham BT26A, he managed to dice with the factory teams and got 2 second-place finishes. In 1970, Frank Williams was convinced by Alejandro de Tomaso to run one of his cars, the new 505/38. This, however, was a major step down, as the car was overweight and unreliable, despite incorporating magnesium into its design. Courage crashed out at Kyalami, then crashed in practice at Jarama and failed to start the race. At the BRDC International Trophy, he managed to show some potential in the car by finishing third. He then finished unclassified in Monaco and lasted only 5 laps at Spa before the oil pressure dropped. At the next round at Zandvoort, there seemed to be some promise as he qualified 9th. He settled into 8th in the early laps and then passed John Miles for 7th on lap 12. At the time, Zandvoort had a very different, much faster second and third sectors made up of a series of high-speed right-handers going through the sand dunes. One of these, Tunnel Oust, had a large bump on it which Courage hit on lap 23 which broke the suspension. The car went up an embankment and got caught in the catch fencing with the engine separating from the chassis, causing the car to burst into flames. This was at the start of the first major push for improved safety standards, where five-point harnesses and full-face helmets were now being adopted, and roll hoops and fireproof overalls were compulsory. As previously mentioned, parts of the car's chassis and suspension were made from magnesium, which was used because it was very light, despite being an extremely volatile metal, this being 10 years before the first carbon fibre Formula One cars. The dangers of using magnesium were already clear and present following the death of Joe Schlesser in the magnesium-bodied Honda RA302 at the French Grand Prix 2 years earlier, where the car burst into white-hot flames. This happened here too, and also ignited the surrounding trees and bushes. In the accident, the front left wheel broke off and struck Courage's head, tearing off his helmet. It is not known if this killed him or if he succumbed to the flames. Frank Williams persevered with the team, but ended the partnership with De Tomaso at the end of the year, and from here onwards kept a sense of distance between himself and his drivers, and it would be another 24 years before there was a death in one of his cars. Courage was buried in the family plot in the churchyard of St. Mary the Virgin in Shenfield, Essex, just a mile and a half from the family home of Fitzwalter's farm.
Well, as all I will say is that it was a major shock. I was very young. You didn't expect a shock like that. And I remembered I went to the race organiser, a man called John Korschmidt, and I said, John, just tell me, is Piers dead? Are you sure he's dead? And he said, I'm sure. And I said, tell me that again. And he told me, he is dead, Frank. Three times. I said, okay. Then I had the job of telling his wife, Piers' wife. And I'd rather not talk about that.
Watkins Glen, home of the United States Grand Prix from 1961 to 1980. For a long time, the Glen was a location for the end-of-season festivities and celebrations from fans and drivers alike. It was, and still is, a top-class racing venue, and was regarded as one of the best facilities on the calendar, which was reflected by the circuit also winning the GPDA Award for the best organised and best staged Grand Prix on three occasions, in 1965, 1970 and 1972. The Seneca Lodge was a prime venue for most drivers to enjoy a few drinks together after the race, and remains open today, complete with its collection of motorsport artefacts on display. And let's not forget Tex Hopkins, who was chief starter at the Glen for a long time, complete with his famous and enthusiastic jump in the air as he waved the green flag, whilst also doing a similar move to wave the checkered flag. One particular area of the Glen, now cemented in history, was the bog. This area became a cheap way for fans to camp and watch the race in an area just outside the circuit boundary. With tickets selling at around $15 for a weekend, hundreds of fans would flock to this area, which would eventually become muddy and boggy due to the area's drainage system or lack thereof. As the 1970s began and youth culture was changing across the world, soon this area for a cheap ticket turned into a lawless festival site. Free beer, cheap drugs, no police, no stewards, and perhaps what the bog is most well known for, the many, many cars that got stuck in the mud being torched. The circuit didn't seem to mind too much, since they were making money and nobody was getting seriously hurt. The crowds would grow larger as time went on, and it truly escalated in 1974, when a Greyhound bus carrying Brazilian fans from New York City, who were keen to watch Emerson Fittipaldi in action, was stolen and taken to the bog where it was torched, along with many other cars. It was also reported that many other cars were also stolen, rather than the cars set on fire in the past being second-hand vehicles that barely worked in the first place. The circuit and police decided that this incident went too far, and the bog began to be policed from then on before being paved over in the 1980s. If you were there, I'm sure you have plenty of memories from this place. F1 also grew concerned about the bog as they believed it was beginning to spoil the glamorous image that F1 was trying to promote itself as. However, despite Watkins Glen being hailed as one of the best circuits around, it has had a troubled past, with some incredibly disturbing accidents taking place here. Even before the permanent circuit that we see today was opened, Watkins Glen was a 6.6 mile public road course, which only ended after an accident resulted in the death of a 7-year-old spectator named Frank Vasari. In 1956, the permanent circuit was opened, but severe accidents continued. Graham Hill experienced a terrifying crash in 1969 when a high-speed tyre blowout led to his Lotus somersaulting down the track, with Graham being thrown out. Suffering major leg fractures, Graham was told he would never race again. But he managed to return in time for the following season. This was also the accident in which Graham gave a brilliant response when asked if he had a message for his wife. "Just tell her I won't be dancing for 2 weeks." But it would be here in the early 1970s where two of the most horrific fatalities in Formula One history would occur, just 1 year apart from one another. Austria never really embraced motorsport until the mid to late 1960s, whereby the rise in popularity of Jochen Rindt inspired many future racing drivers. This was noticeable in the early 1970s as more and more Austrian drivers began to enter the F1 world. Some went on to become some of the greatest drivers in the world, whilst others fell by the wayside early in their careers and their names forgotten with the passage of time. One such name that is often forgotten about today is the 25-year-old Helmut Koenig. Born in Vienna in 1948, the young Austrian initially wasn't born surrounded by the world of motorsport. Instead, he spent a lot of his youth skiing in the Styrian Mountains in southeastern Austria, and from there he found an interest in speed sports. In fact, he was actually a very talented skier, and was selected for the Austrian national B team. Skiing became almost a part of his daily life, which only fueled his desire for speed and, of course, the young Helmut began to consider trying out car racing. This would also satisfy his interest in engineering, as he had studied the subject in school, as well as journalism. However, Helmut needed money if he was going to even get close to a car. So, in 1966, he moved to Sweden, where he lived and worked there for several months. His parents were wealthy pharmacists, but were opposed to Helmut's plans of becoming a racing driver, so he was left to find money on his own. Eventually though, in 1969, Helmut managed to scrape enough money together to purchase a second-hand Mini Cooper S from another young Austrian driver who'd just moved up to Formula V. That driver was Niki Lauda. Helmut used this new Mini to enter several touring car races, and was surprisingly competitive from the get-go. His impressive natural talent caught the attention of another young Austrian Formula V driver, Helmut Marko. With Marko's encouragement, Koenig was invited to test drive a Formula V car alongside Marko. Despite him having no prior experience with single-seaters, his lap times weren't that much slower than Marko's, and this led to him getting a drive in Formula V, which eventually led to a full-time seat the following season in 1970. His natural talent behind the wheel only improved from here, and he began to make a serious name for himself in Formula V, and before long, a potential race seat in Formula 2 with March beckoned. But in the end, he had to turn away from the deal, as he could not find enough sponsorship money for the drive. His seat was taken instead by Niki Lauda. Koenig returned to Formula V, and also began to take part in the European Formula Super V Championship in 1971. This evolved into Helmut also taking part in British Formula Ford races in that same year, including a stunning victory at Brands Hatch. Despite winning the Formula V Championship in 1973 though, he knew that he wanted to be in far bigger things, especially after getting so close to entering Formula 2 just a couple of years ago. But luckily, Porsche offered him a contract in the World Sports Car Championship in 1974, driving a Porsche 911 Carrera RSR, and Ford Cologne offered him a seat in touring car racing that season too. His career was really starting to get traction, and he also married a young Austrian airline stewardess in May of that same year, and things would only get better from here. Following his exploits in sports car racing, he had finally managed to secure enough funds to pay for a drive in Formula One using a Brabham BT42 with the Scuderia Fenota team. He knew it wasn't going to be competitive, but that wasn't going to stop him from making his first appearance in Formula One at the Austrian Grand Prix in 1974, but he would sadly fail to qualify for his home race. He didn't get the chance to actually race, but onlookers were still impressed by his performances, and John Surtees took a particular liking to him. So much so, he invited him to test a Surtees TS16 at Goodwood. This test drive was successful, and Surtees offered him a short contract to drive at the last two races of that season at a Canadian Grand Prix at Motorsport Park and the United States Grand Prix at Watkins Glen. He had done it. Koenig could truly consider himself a Formula One driver after many years of hard work trying to get here, and there he was, ready to show the world what he was truly capable of. And it's Formula One. This is where the world will be watching. He managed to qualify this time, and in a respectable 22nd place, even beating his more experienced teammate Derek Bell, who failed to qualify. His first race start went even better, and despite him being a rookie, managed his Surtees to an incredible 10th place finish, beating the likes of Jackie Yicks and Mark Donoghue in the process. His true talent was on full show, regardless of his rookie status, and bigger teams already began to quietly monitor his progress. Already being labelled as a great prospect for 1975 and beyond, Helmuth Koenig and the Surtees team arrived at Watkins Glen with little pressure on their shoulders, and Helmuth was looking forward to having another enjoyable race once again. But it was race day, the 6th of October, 1974, where this story ends. After enjoying another good qualifying session, where he placed his Surtees 23rd on the grid and once again out-qualified his teammate, perhaps Helmuth thought he could recreate his performances at Canada and climb through the field once again over the 59-lap race. He didn't have the best of starts, but after 9 laps he was still running well, whilst the battle for the championship raged on at the front of the field. But at the hairpin of turn 7, on the toe of the relatively new boot section, a single car suddenly went straight on into the barrier. The photos you are seeing on screen do not show the true brutality of this accident. According to witnesses, as Helmuth entered the hairpin, his car continued on into the catch fencing, which did manage to slow his car down, but not enough to stop him from hitting the Armco barriers. In fact, the car's slow speed led many to initially believe that this was just a small accident that no one could possibly be injured from. This barrier, though, was not properly installed. When Koenig hit the barrier, the bottom rail gave way, allowing Surtees to pass through, but the top rail stayed in place. You can probably imagine what happened next. Helmuth Koenig was decapitated. Marshals rushed to the scene, expecting to find Koenig alive and well, only to find his bloodied and headless corpse sat with his arms crossed in the cockpit. Contrary to popular belief, Koenig's head was not lying on the racetrack. It was found resting on top of the ruined engine block. I do not wish to show you the worst photos from this accident, but they are available on the internet if you so wish. Despite the sheer brutality, the race was not stopped, and instead of extracting the poor young Austrian out of the car, marshals instead decided to just shamefully cover the car with a tarpaulin, with Helmuth's body still sat inside. It took a while before Surtees became aware of the severity of the accident, and teammate Jose Dolan was called in to retire and withdraw from the event. Niki Lauda too was also deeply saddened by the news, as they had been racing each other for much of their youth. The cause of the accident is still very much a mystery to this day, as there was very little information about the accident at the time, but it is widely accepted that it was a front suspension failure that led to Helmuth losing control in the braking zone of the hairpin. We will never know how good Helmuth could have been in Formula One, but that's a recurring theme when you look at death in the sport. All the young Austrian wanted to do was be the best he could be, but he never really got the chance of that either. Helmuth was laid to rest in Heitzing Cemetery in Vienna, Austria. This accident is also one of the most disturbing in Formula One history, and if you are hearing about this accident for the first time, you are probably thinking to yourself how something as simple as an improperly fitted barrier could go unnoticed and later cause so much suffering. Poorly installed barriers were very common in the early days of barrier safety, and Helmuth's crash was not the first time Watkins Glen had experienced a crash of this severity, as exactly 365 days before this accident, a young driver was destined to become a world champion someday, only to join the long list of the dead. I'm sure you know his name. His piercing blue eyes, infectious smile, and his enormous good looks. One young man from Paris, France, arrived on the F1 scene and was beloved by everyone who was lucky enough to meet or work with him. A charming lad, willing to learn everything there was to learn. A talented musician, but also an incredibly talented racing driver whose legacy is still very strong to millions of people around the world today. His name was Albert François Sauveur. Born into a wealthy Jewish family in February 1944, his father Charles Goldenberg was a member of the French resistance fighting against German occupation whilst also protecting his young children from deportation. Charles registered the children using François's mother's maiden name of Sauveur. Years after the war ended, as François grew up, he decided to keep the Sauveur name. When he was 16, he didn't have an interest in motorsport until his sister got engaged to another young aspiring driver, Jean-Pierre Beltoir. As the two got to know each other, François started to take a liking to motorsport, and it wasn't long before he was participating in local motorcycle races. Soon though, national service beckoned, and his time with the French military would put a temporary halt to his motorsport plans. Soon after completing his national service, he would return to racing in 1966 and enrolled at the famous Winfield Racing School, which was then based at the new Manicourt circuit. Here his career would move up to the next level as he won the scholarship, with his prize being an Alpine Formula 3 car. The problem was, however, he still couldn't get the necessary funding to maintain and race this car, and his career looked destined to fizzle out before it even managed to get going. Luckily though, in 1968, he managed to secure funding, and he quickly set out to swap his poor Alpine car with a Techno car, who had a good reputation for F3 and F2 cars back then. Almost instantly, François was competitive with this car in Formula 3, and he went on to win the 1968 French Formula 3 Championship, which earned him a move up to Formula 2 with the Works Techno team. It would be this year that he would be noticed by a man that he looked up to, Jackie Stewart. During a Formula 2 race at the Crystal Palace circuit, Stewart would have a tough on-track battle with François, until he would eventually make a mistake and crash out from the race. This left a lasting impression on Jackie and quietly informed Ken Tyrrell to monitor the progress of the Frenchman. After finishing third in the European Formula 2 Championship in 1969, including entering the F2 class of the German Grand Prix that year, it looked like 1970 would be another year of F2 for François. This was until the experienced Johnny Servoz Gavin suddenly retired from F1 after just 3 rounds, leaving an empty seat at Tyrrell. Jackie immediately recommended hiring François. He was now in the big leagues, the very top of professional motorsport. His first Grand Prix would be the Dutch Grand Prix at Zandvoort in a customer March 701, as Tyrrell weren't building their own cars just yet. He qualified in a lowly 15th and would retire during the race with engine troubles. Francois, though, would come face to face with the grim realities of Grand Prix racing that day, though. As we saw earlier in this episode, Piers Courage lost his life in a fiery accident during this race, and Francois had to deal with that in his first ever F1 race. Francois didn't attend a funeral, and neither did he attend any funeral, as he deeply disliked them, and would never talk to Jackie about his fears on the circuit. Still though, the season went on, and so did he, and he only got faster and faster, eventually getting to the point where he scored his first points in F1 after finishing 6th at the Italian Grand Prix. Whilst practicing for that race, he would experience a near 200 miles per hour spin, but Francois would just simply laugh it off with his friends. On that same day, Jochen Rindt lost his life in an accident at the Parabolica corner. Once again, Francois had to face this reality, and also had to look out for Jackie, who was deeply affected by Jochen's death. The two drivers' friendships would grow exponentially from here. They both admired each other's skills, and Francois was eager to learn from Jackie, and Jackie was more than happy to teach him everything he knew.
And then I get into Formula One. So in fact, I was what you could call a mad driver. I was driving like hell. I was not thinking enough to what I was doing. And Jackie stopped all that and teach me how you must analyze a car, how you must think when you are driving, what kind of vision you must have. He did all my education.
In 1971, it was clear that this friendship was working, as Francois was becoming an incredible F1 driver, whilst Jackie clinched his second world title with their teamwork helping Tyrrell win the constructors' title with the brand new Tyrrell 002. Francois also won his first Grand Prix at the United States Grand Prix at Watkins Glen. He had truly arrived and was loving every second of it. With everything going in the right direction, the following year would be unsuccessful for Francois, as he would finish 6th in the championship with only 2 podium finishes to show for. He did, however, finish 2nd in that year's 24 Hours of Le Mans in the Matra Simca MS670 and win the Road Atlanta round of the Can-Am Championship. The Stewart and Sever partnership was still very strong, and Francois' confidence in his own ability was only growing, as well as Jackie's admiration for him. The duo's friendship had grown to become one of the closest ever seen in Formula One. They would often go on holiday together, and much of their spare time was spent together. Francois was like a brother to Jackie, and he loved him. As Jackie once recalled, Jim Clark had taught him everything he knew, so Jackie passed his knowledge down to Francois to create a fantastic racing driver, who would one day become Tyrrell team leader, and would very likely become a world champion. In 1973, it was Tyrrell versus Lotus for the title. Tyrrell knew it would be tough to fight off Emerson Fittipaldi and Ronnie Peterson, but they would give it their all, and with Francois now almost at the same level as Jackie, he had confidence they would do it, despite himself being in a period of ill mental health, and thoughts of retirement started to creep into Jackie's mind. Nevertheless, Tyrrell won 3 out of the first 6 races, with the other 3 going to Lotus. Francois was also proving that he was ready, as for most of this season, he was able to comfortably keep up with Jackie throughout these races. If you were able to keep up with Jackie Stewart in his prime, then you were a damn good racing driver. Around the summer of 1973, Jackie Stewart secretly decided he was to retire from F1 at the end of the season. The only person who was aware of this was Ken Tyrrell, who Jackie felt he had to tell because he didn't want to leave him with that kind of news at such short notice, and would allow him to prepare for it when it eventually arrived. Francois wasn't aware of this either, but he would frequently speak about how he would love to beat Jackie fairly one day, and of course, he had no idea that he was to become Tyrrell team leader for 1974.
I said, Jackie is still the maestro for me because he's the only man, maybe in the world, to be able to do a whole Grand Prix of 90 laps, 2 hours racing without making one mistake.
But then you say...
But I think I am on one lap, I am now as fast as Jackie.
What does that mean? What do you have to do to beat him?
Not to make any mistakes.
How does that come?
Experience, concentration, and also being able to set your car so well that it will be the easiest car to drive in the race. And Jackie is so good in analyzing the car, he's reading the car so well that when the flag drops, he has always a very easy car to drive. He doesn't have to fight with his car because the car is not going around the corner very well, so he has to fight. Never. Jackie always managed to fix his car such a way that it would be very easy to drive.
At the Italian Grand Prix, Jackie Stewart won his third world title, enabling him to end his career on a high. After a disappointing race in Canada, F1 went to Watkins Glen for the final race of the season, the United States Grand Prix. A race in which Francois was confident in winning. He had the car to do it, and his only other win so far was at Watkins Glen just 2 years before. This was Jackie Stewart's 100th Grand Prix, and he was also eager to win this race. But Ken Tyrrell suggested that he let Francois win this race, as it would be a fantastic way for him to pass the torch over to Francois, who would continue to lead the Tyrrell team to bigger and greater things in the near future. Initially hesitant to allow this, both Jackie and Ken agreed to discuss this again after qualifying. They would never have this conversation. During the closing stages of Saturday morning qualifying, the track suddenly fell into a haunting silence. A car had crashed on a fast and unforgiving S's section, with debris spread across the entire section of track. Jody Scheckter was first on scene to the accident and was able to return to the pit lane to report on what had happened, as nobody in the pits knew for quite some time. Jody parked his car and people rushed to him to ask what had happened. One name started to spread around the paddock. It was Francois. Francois was chasing down Ronnie Peterson's provisional pole time and was going faster than he had ever done before. On the run-up to the fast right-to-left corners on the uphill S's section, Francois suddenly lost control of his Tyrrell and he glanced the barrier on the right-hand side, which sent the car into a spin at 150 miles per hour across the track and into the barriers on the left-hand side. The Tyrrell hit this barrier at a near 90-degree angle, and the car began to lift into the air. This barrier became dislodged upon impact, and as the car began to become airborne, the barrier began to peel away with it. The car eventually rested upside down, with its engine block and rear wing sticking out just behind the barrier. The front end of the car was completely destroyed and spread across the track, which prevented other drivers from passing through safely. When Jody Scheckter reached the ruined Tyrrell, he discovered the shockingly horrifying sight. Parts of the barrier that had become uprooted in the crash penetrated his body, which cut him from his hip and up to his neck. Not just the car, but Francois was quite literally ripped apart in the accident, in one of the most gruesome accidents that F1 had ever seen. During my research, I was able to find one photo from the scene of the accident, but out of respect, I will not be showing it here. Jackie Stewart was inconsolable, as were many other drivers across the grid who loved Francois for the close friendships that he had built throughout. After the accident was cleared away and the ruined Tyrrell returned to the pit, the mechanics began to speculate whether it was a mechanical failure, and many of the men who had worked on his car began to blame themselves for the accident. Jackie took it upon himself to determine the cause and drove out on a fact-finding mission. For him, he would take the S's section in fourth gear, giving him a lower engine range, but have easier control over his car. Francois, however, preferred to use third gear, giving him a higher engine range, but would result in an extremely nervous car at the top of the S's, this being the consequence of the faster option. When Jackie tried this, he noted the car was extremely hard to control doing this. There was also a small bump at the top of the S's, which was more noticeable in the Tyrrell, which had a shorter wheelbase, and would have jumped more going through these bumps. Francois was also pushing extremely hard to beat the then fastest time by the Lotus of Ronnie Peterson. Ultimately, it was determined that there was no mechanical failure of the car which caused the accident, and Francois had simply driven too fast and made a simple mistake of riding the left-hand side curbing with the car already beyond its limit. This was enough to send the car into a spin and into the barriers at 150 miles per hour. Knowing this, Jackie reassured the devastated mechanics that it wasn't their fault. Soon after, Stewart decided that enough was enough, and out of respect to his fallen friend, retired from Formula One a day early, ending a career spanning 8 years, 3 World Championships, and 99 Grand Prix starts. Spare a moment for Jackie, who throughout his racing career had to deal with the loss of many close friends. Jochen Rindt, Jim Clark, Piers Courage, François Sauveur, Bruce McLaren, and Joe Bonnier, amongst many others. Jackie's wife Helen once counted 57 close friends and colleagues who had died in racing accidents, many of whom Jackie was there to witness them. Tyrrell also withdrew from the weekend, and they were left without their team leader and future world champion for 1974. It is also often said that this was the beginning of the end for the Tyrrell team, who could never get back to the highs of the Stewart and Sauveur duo, and their results slowly declined for many years after, until their last season in 1998, after which they were taken over by British American Racing, and the rest, as they say, is history. Ken Tyrrell passed away in August 2001, and the story of Tyrrell was permanently saved when the famous Tyrrell shed, where the cars were built and maintained, was successfully bought and moved to the Goodwood Circuit in West Sussex in 2024. As for Watkins Glen, the deaths of Sauveur and Koenig would have an effect on the circuit, as the chicane was installed before the S's section to slow the cars down. But in 1980, Watkins Glen would see its last Grand Prix, as F1 had simply outgrown the circuit, and has not returned since. And finally, 5 days after his death, Albert François Sauveur Goldenberg was laid to rest in Valdenay, with his close friends and family there to wish him farewell. In 1985, his father Charles Goldenberg passed away, and in 2001, his mother Huguette Sauveur also passed away. They are both buried next to François. Thankfully, the legacy of François is still very strong, still being remembered by many people in F1 today, including Jackie Stewart, who still gets emotional talking about it 50 years later. Let's hope that Francois is never ever forgotten about.
Because I prefer a thrilling life. I enjoy, you know, the fantastic thing. I think every man in the world is looking for that. Is to make his passion his business. That's what I have done. I had passion for motor racing, and it's my business. Cannot be more happy. Everything I do about motor racing, I enjoy it. Anything, because it is my passion.
Do you know what's weird? Well, 4 years ago, I wasn't interested in motorsport. In fact, I was one of those people that once said, oh, why would I want to watch motorsport? It's just going round and round and round. And it's one of those things that when you try it, it sticks to you like glue. You can't get away from it. I remember when I sat down to watch my first F1 race and thought to myself, wow, this is actually really cool. And I watched the next one, and the next one, and the next one. And 4 years later, I'm here, doing all these documentaries on YouTube. I mean, growing up, I knew of names of Mika Hakkinen, and Michael Schumacher, and David Coulthard, Pablo Montoya, all those kind of people, but I never once thought I'd be a fan of F1 or the World Endurance Championships or touring cars or anything like that. And that just stemmed from just one race. And that's all it took for this virus to come into my life, and hasn't gone away. It's just gotten worse in some ways. And that's kind of what spawned this particular series, where a lot of you will probably think, well, F1's most horrific crash is going to be one of those compilations. But so many of you clicked on it and realised there's something different. And that wasn't a choice. I didn't think, oh, I'm going to make it like that because so-and-so's done it like this. I thought, no, I've got to do it my way, how I want to do it, and how I feel a lot of the people mentioned would like to see it done. And of course, their families and friends and everyone else. And that's how it became a thing. And I'm just so glad and relieved that so many of you at home have clicked on it, watched it, and appreciated it for how it is. And to be honest, for me, I think to really understand what happened in a lot of these segments that we spoke about, you've got to know who the driver is, where they are, the circuit, for example, what's at stake, what's the championship, you know, what's going on there, how it happened, and what effect it had after. And I wanted you to feel something, rather than just sit there and take in a bunch of information and move on with your life. I wanted you to genuinely feel something. So then when, say, an accident such as, I don't know, Tom Price occurred, you felt a bit of a sense of loss rather than just going, oh, that's a bad crash. Because you think of names such as Tom Price and you think of his horrible accident in 1977, but you don't really know much about him, the person. And I wanted this series to be more about the person rather than strictly what happened on these events. Because some of them were truly horrific, such as what you saw in this episode with Francois Cervère and Helmuth Koenig. And it's nice, in a way, because so many names that we've spoken about in this series, such as, you know, Koenig, for example, or perhaps Riccardo Paletti or Mike Hailwood, they don't really get much mention in mainstream media anymore, which is a big shame. And I know exclusively I'm not the one carrying on their memory. So many genuine creators online do it. And I just hope that I'm helping, you know, keep their memory alive. I really, really do. So that, yeah, you see, I don't know, you go to Goodwood, for example, and you see Peter Revson's car, one of his McLarens, and you go, I know who he is, I know what he did, and I know his legacy and his achievements. And it's just really nice, and I just hope that one person, at least one, is watching and actually learned something. Because I don't know if it resonates on camera, but I'm genuinely passionate about all things motorsport. And of course, F1 was and still is the main thing, but this channel being Motorsport Madness, I like to try and, you know, talk about all of them. But there's some characters out there that really were just awe-inspiring. That's why in the modern day F1 world, I really do hate it when I see people throwing hate at Lewis Hamilton or Max Verstappen. Because it's just not necessary. We're not the ones in the car. They are. And I'm sure if we weren't there, there'd be no point in racing. But there are some truly amazing people that I've learned about that I knew beforehand, but I didn't really know much about them as a person. One of those names being Pedro Rodriguez. And every time I think about that name, I think about him and Josipha goes side by side in the 917 up Air Rouge on the opening lap of Spa 1,000 kilometres. And I just think, how brave do you have to be? How much courage do you have to be to do that, let alone doing that in an F1 car, but a Porsche 917? unbelievable. And so many more characters throughout the history of motorsport are like that. And we always wonder what it's, how much courage you need. Because it's easy for us human beings to look at them and go, well, you're a bit stupid, or you're a bit weird for doing that. And we do. We often do criticize drivers. They think, oh, I should be banned or whatever. But they know what they're doing. And I go back to what I said at the start of episode one, and I say, the drivers, they know the risks. They know at any point they could be hurt or killed. But that's what they want to do. That is what they want to do. And who are we to stop them? But when we're talking about bravery, there was one particular story that really stood out to me. And it was in episode two, right near the end. And when I flick through the comments, and you could do that now, you could flick through the comments of episode two, as so many people talk about him and the bravery this man showed on this particular day. And I thought the same thing. It really was something unbelievable. And something that has stuck with me, just the image of what happened on this particular day. And today, we're going to go off and pay special tribute to this wonderful man. And here he is. What this man did at Zandvoort in 1973 was really something horrible to watch. But this man was probably one of the bravest men I've ever witnessed. Obviously, I wasn't there at the time, but what he did was just incredible. But as we know, it was in vain. And a lot of these drivers we looked at, again, ended in the same way. But what this documentary series has been, it's been a tribute to them. And for the next few minutes of this video, we'll be paying tribute to many of those who we've spoken about over these last four episodes. So before then, I'd just like to thank all of you for watching, for subscribing, for the Patreons, for commenting, for liking, disliking, even just watching. I just want to thank you all. So, until next time, I've been Jack Palmer. This is Motorsport Badness. See you again soon.
Rosandi Handens die Hinke Haldens die Hände Allur heimur in Óskir Lema þú stendur Rannlætur Allur en votur Engin kom í stíð Laupandinn í okkur vill springa og tóskir Vindur í og ótegir ég af hárinu þínu Ég andur things fast all year, dear. They'll never be meaner. Happy Park Rembleite Og ég fær blóna sér En ég stund alltaf Í sjönd lóð Í sjönd lóð Í sjönd Oh, you fight blown us here. Oh, you stand up, stabs. He shines the light he knows.
I'd had 8 years of racing. In 8 years, I got to the top. So I decided now's the time. Thank you all very, very much indeed for coming along, be so patient to listen to me. And I hope one day some of you will come along and join me and we'll empty that knot. Thank you very much.
I was motorcycle champion of Mexico before I was 15, and I started racing cars when I was 15. And I was again champion of Mexico at 17, and not until I was 17 I started racing international. I like to have strong drivers in my team and race against strong drivers like X, Mario Andretti, and Baccarella, because they make me go faster still.